I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a young girl who makes the kind of discovery most adopted children make at some point in their lives when they find out that they come from somewhere else. For Deborah Jang Stein, it didn't change things that much. She'd grown up with very loving parents, but it did help answer some questions she'd had about not looking anything like her mom and dad. Deborah's big discovery came a little later when she found out that she'd been born in a federal prison. It wasn't until she was in her 30s that she got to see her own files.
So in those prison files, though, are letters from my foster parents to my mother in prison. And they talk about when my first teeth came in and my first words and, you know, my life was chronicled. I have the Bureau of Prisons file of 900 pages for my baby book.
Deborah's trip takes her back to the prison hospital where she was born and back to the cell block where she was raised. Her story's coming up right after the news. There are more women in prison today than at any time in this country's history. Obviously, that means there are more mothers behind bars and more children being born in prison than ever before. Some countries allow babies to stay with their mothers in prison. Others don't. In most U.S. states, babies are taken away from incarcerated mothers. Sometimes it's done right away, and sometimes later, about the time the child learns to walk. Today's story is about one woman who discovers that she was born in prison. And then she gets the chance to see the prison file that details her first year.
So in there are my baby pictures, which I'd never seen.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Deborah Jang Stein says she always felt a bit different from her parents. She had a wonderful home on the West Coast, and she was very close to her mother and father. When she was about 8, she got the first piece of the puzzle.
You know, I always knew something was amiss about me. I didn't know what. And maybe my parents knew that. I never talked about it. And I remember my mother gardening and kneeling on the side of the house. We lived in Seattle. There was, you know, half an acre, an orchard, right in the city. My parents had apple trees. My father had a study out back. My parents were professors. And I just remember standing under the clothesline. My mother was kneeling and digging, and she said, "You're adopted." And I didn't ask anything. She didn't say anything more. It was just sort of this, something dropped on me like a bomb.
You said that you knew something was amiss. Does that mean that you kind of suspected that you were adopted? What do you mean?
I didn't look anything like my parents. My father's 6'5", I'm 5'3". I knew I was some kind of mix of Asian and Hispanic, and I later found out Greek. My parents just, I would watch them check the other box on forms for me. So I knew that. And, that, you know, my parents, my family's Jewish, so I knew I looked different. And I really didn't even bother to think about why. So I wasn't surprised when my mother told me. I was surprised that I didn't know what to ask, and she didn't know any more to say.
When did that conversation start up again? Did you ever, you know, say over the dinner table, "So, where do I come from?"
The answers to my questions were always, "We love you like you're ours." That's a beautiful thing now. It's not enough when you're 8 and you wonder why your skin's brown. And I knew, for example, my father had a job offer in Texas at Rice University. And I remember him talking with my mother, and I don't know if I eavesdropped or they told me. They were concerned about our moving there as a family for fear what people would think of us. I remember them saying that I might be considered a migrant farm worker, not the daughter of two academics.
Deborah Jang Stein remained curious about where she'd come from, but her parents weren't giving her any more details. A few years later, Deborah was about 12, and she went looking for the answers again.
I remember being grounded one day and just snooping around the house, and I ended up in my mother's bedroom, and I was digging through her lingerie drawer, and, you know, the slips and the soaps and the scent, and I remember it so clearly because it was, my life changed after that. I found a letter that they'd written to their family lawyer asking to change my birthplace from the federal prison in Alderson to Seattle, because that's where I was born in their hearts. And I really don't remember much after that, but my world just spun out of control.
Did you get it right away? I mean, once you read that letter, did you think to yourself, "Oh my God, I was born in a prison"?
Yep, I got it, and I felt like I fit somewhere.
Oh, like a piece fell into place.
Exactly. It took me a long time to feel completely whole, but I felt like I was, you know, the puzzle was being fit together. But it also gave me a reason for why I felt out of the ordinary.
Did you confront your parents with this, or did you even tell them you found the letter?
Nothing. It was my secret. I just tucked it in my little pocket, and I carried it for about 10 years.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. That letter included a few other fascinating details. Deborah Jang Stein also found out that her birth name had been Madeline Mary. Now, while Deborah says she didn't discuss this with her parents, she remembers that the letter had also given her the address of the prison. And soon after, she tried contacting prison authorities.
I started writing the prison and saying, I know I was born there. I don't know exactly when. And I pretty much did. I felt like a birthday present to myself. I did it year after year. I remember being about 16 and having driving lessons. And when I got my permit, I drove to the adoption agency in Seattle and asked a social worker to give me my file. And she sat there and said, well, we know your mother, your first mother's name. We know you were born there. And I knew that much. And I said, but I want to know what I am. I don't want to check the other box. I want to know who she is, why she was there. And I never found out. So it just set, you know, it stewed like this venom.
How did it change you? How did your own behavior
change? I
felt like
I belonged somewhere. I also got really wild in school. You know, looking back, now it all makes sense. But I was an above-average student. I started getting failing grades. I skipped school. I'd pull fire alarms. Didn't go to class. Spent most of my day in the principal's office. I went wild.
So your parents would say to you, as any parents would, you know, Deborah, what's going on? You've changed. You used to have such good grades. Now you're cutting up all the time.
Right.
What's going on? And what would you say to them?
They didn't ask that. I don't remember ever being asked that. I remember a principal saying, what's wrong with you? You have a good home and a great family. And I don't remember what I answered because I had the secret. I felt like a toughness was coming out of me. It didn't fit with, you know, the world I was growing up in. I was taking piano lessons and French lessons. I went to a private school. And then the other part of my world, I'm starting to run the streets and get in trouble and hang out with boys a lot older. And
how wild did you get, Deborah?
Well, the rule breaking at school turned into maybe a 5 or 6 year lawless part of my life. I hooked up with some ex-felons, and we ran up and down the coast into Mexico and California, and, you know, up to no good is what I say.
Were you running drugs at the time?
I was doing things like that. It's awkward to talk about because I have two young kids, and my life is so different, and, you know, a lot of it is unresolved.
Yeah.
A lot of fast money, fast cars, smuggling scams. Whenever we'd get close to being busted and the threat was, well, you might go to prison, that never scared me. And I still didn't talk about it. And I was running around with guys that had been in and out of prison.
Probably, guys who were much older than you then.
You know, really, I just hooked up with thugs and outlaws. And it was still, I'm going home to my parents. You know, I have this contrast. And in some ways, I felt like I fit right in between both worlds.
And you could live this dual life. Your parents weren't calling you on your stuff, saying, you know, where have you been for the past 10 days or anything like
well,
that?
Well, I remember a period where I went a year and didn't talk to them. They didn't know where I was, and I didn't think to call them. And
how old would you have been at that time, Deborah?
20s.
Yeah. You'd found out that you were born in a prison. You'd gone a little bit wild.
I know.
And the idea that you might wind up in prison as a lawbreaker yourself didn't really seem to bother you that much.
Never scared me. Well, and I can remember police pulling us over for something. Who knows what? But what I remember is someone saying that to us in the questioning. And I think it was a woman officer sort of trying to ploy me and, you know, take me aside. You know, this could end up in prison for you. And that didn't scare me.
Deborah Jang Stein wound up in Minnesota staying with relatives who were tolerant of her wilder years. She still wanted to know the details of her birth and those first months of hers in prison. And then one day, kind of out of the blue, she heard from the prison authorities.
And one day I got a call from one of the officers in Alderson. And I don't remember the conversation because all I remember is that I interrupted and said, can I come down there?
This is to the women's prison in West Virginia, right?
The Federal Women's Prison in Alderson, West Virginia. Okay. I spent the day there. The warden welcomed me.
So how much did you get to see of the prison? Were you just sort of in the visitor's lounge?
I saw everything. No, I saw everything. They took me to the cell where my mother was, maybe 6 by 10 feet. I remember is pretty primal. It was beige and tan. There was a bed and a table. We walked across the compound and went to a room underneath the chapel. And I remember looking up and seeing the peeling paint, and the officer said, "And this is where the women come to get letters." And I remember nearly collapsing because the smell was so familiar. Wow. Not in a bad way.
Yeah.
It was primal for me. The paint, the color, the smell of it. They then took me to a building that had been the hospital, and they said, "This is probably where you were born." So I realized there I was probably seeing more than most people know. After all those years of wandering, I'm actually walking in my first home.
What changed for the prison officials? Why did they finally decide, hey, let's just talk to this woman?
I really don't know, other than maybe laws changed.
Now, was this the time when you found out the name of your birth mother?
Oh, I did find it out then. Lots of it was blocked out for federal privacy rules, but I found her name. I found out that she was pregnant when she was sentenced, that she'd done some other time. She was a heroin addict. You know, these days she would have been put in treatment probably, but she did everything that goes along with that. I found out that she had cleaned up, and she had already died.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Years later, Deborah Jangstein was able to contact the family of her birth mother and find out what actually happened to her.
She had cleaned up, and I'm told the story that she was interested in finding a detective to find me.
How old was she when she died?
I think young, maybe 50 or something.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing that with all, you know, with everything she'd been through, she just died a natural death. I mean, by disease, but. Yeah.
And so learning all this stuff about your mother, did it help?
I loved it.
I know, but did it help you understand yourself better? Were there things that you learned about your mother when you went, oh, okay, now I get it, you know?
You know, I don't think I put it together then. It was so, I just took it in and it felt right. I didn't judge anything about it. It still didn't feel right because of the way I grew up, because my being for so long had nothing in a lot of ways to do with how I was being brought up.
Yeah, you had a great childhood, right? I mean, in relative
really?
Terms.
Really? I mean, we went to Europe. My father would get sabbaticals. He got a Guggenheim. We'd travel. I went to camp. I really did have a great childhood, but it didn't. This piece didn't fit. Everything just kept colliding.
Are you feeling sad while you're there? Are you just sort of filled with wonder?
No, I was exhilarated. I felt like I'd gone home.
Deborah Jangstein eventually got her hands on her mother's file and learned even more about where she'd come from and her first months.
I was given a prison inmate newsletter that announced my birth.
And I'll talk more with Deborah about looking back and what else she found in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Prison officials estimate that 5% of the women who are put in prison in the U.S. arrive pregnant. There are only a handful of prisons that have nurseries. In most other cases, the children are taken from the mothers and raised by family members or in foster care. That's what happened to Deborah Jangstein. She says she always knew that she was adopted. She discovered in her early teens that she was born in a prison in West Virginia and that she'd spent the first year of her life there. Deborah also learned that her birth name had been Madeline Mary, and that she was a mixed-race child with some Asian and Hispanic and Greek blood. Deborah had written to the prison, and they'd finally invited her to visit and to look through her own file.
I was given a prison inmate newsletter that announced my birth, and the women talking about how I was laughing down the hall, and I felt like I was just at a slumber party. It was 200 women. And me.
As Madeline Mary, not as Deborah, right?
As Madeline Mary, right. 200 women with, you know, no one to love but me. Oh, and the other thing is, as I was on that tour, I mean, this is where I kept seeing, some, whether you call it miracles or divine intervention, the warden's house is on the compound there. And as I was on that tour, the warden, she walked me around the ground, a white picket fence with some grave markers. And we stood there, and I didn't know what was going on. She said, well, these are the babies that didn't make it. And I was just overwhelmed. It didn't strike me till later that you know, I was lucky. And she said that. She said, you were one of the lucky ones. And I don't know whether it was health care or babies who died because they, too, were born addicts and didn't have the right care.
Yeah, I was going to say, if your mom was a heroin addict and you were born...
Which explains why... It was a joke, and then afterwards it wasn't a joke, but I used to say to my comrades and, you know, the thugs I was hanging around with, I'd say, well, you know, it's really like mother's milk, which, well, you know, that was pretty overwhelming when I found that out. And I also, you know, of course, I saw that she was nursing me and then went through withdrawal, and it's really a sad story for her. For me, it became a story of light. But I saw how lucky I am to be alive. The graves, the, you know, addicted at birth, living on the edge.
There must have been quite a paper trail that told of your mother's arrest and her incarceration and your birth and your adoption and all that stuff.
Right.
Was there a big, you know, Madeline Mary or Deborah file that you could get your hands
on? There's a 900-page file that I have. So I did what the warden did. I petitioned the Bureau of Prisons. It's a great story. And then I called the guy because I'm pretty immediate in a lot of ways. And he said, well, I got your request, but I'm in the middle of reading Al Capone's file. And his job was to black out Martin. And I love that, you know, coming from where I came from. I thought, perfect, it's Al Capone, and then it's me. His job was to black out names for the Privacy Act.
So wait a second. They wouldn't release your file to you until someone had been through it with the black marker, right?
Page by page. With a black marker.
Oh, what an excruciating wait. How long did it take you to...
Very long. And I started feeling... I had this relationship with a privacy officer because I told him what I wanted to know. I said, that's me. So in there are my baby pictures, which I'd never seen.
How old were you when you got this file then, Deborah?
Probably in my 30s. And my adoptive family had pictures of me, but, you know, when I was adopted around 2 or 3... They knew me for a while, but my birth mother wouldn't sign a release to relinquish her rights.
Yeah.
And I know all this because I'm reading about it in the prison file. So what I read, I saw the custody battle at one point, you know, what to do with me? What do we do with this baby in here? And then...
Let me figure that one out. You were in prison with your birth mother for a year.
About a year.
Now, was it then the prison that determined that you couldn't stay there, that you had to be adopted or taken out of the prison?
They just didn't know what to do. I almost was placed in foster care in West Virginia.
And this is all in the file?
It's all in the file. I found all that out after it. All this correspondence. You know, I mean, I could have been a coal miner's daughter instead of the daughter of two professors. And I don't have judgment either way about that, but those are two different worlds.
So did you go straight from prison to a bedroom with your...
I didn't. I went into foster care.
And how long were you in foster care?
I think for a couple of years. My mother told me a story, you know, I was maybe in my 20s. She did tell me that when I was in foster care, they couldn't keep me overnight. But she said we would pick you up from foster care and you were with us all day, but you had to go back and sleep.
So just so that I'm clear on this, your birth mother didn't want to sign the papers to give you
up.
She
wanted to keep me.
Right. That put you in a kind of limbo. You had to stay with a foster family in the evenings while your adoptive family would spend the days with you, right?
Right, because she wouldn't sign. So in those prison files, though, are letters from my foster parents blacked out, you know, the signatures blacked out, to my mother in prison saying, we know that we can't tell you who we are, but we thought you'd like to know that little Madeline's doing great. And they talk about when my first teeth came in and my first words and, you know, my life was chronicled. The government had my baby book is how I look at it. Most people have a baby book. I have the Bureau of Prisons file of 900 pages for my baby book.
Was your mother finally persuaded to relinquish you? Yeah?
She was. I read the letters and she wanted a good life for me. I don't remember. She had another 5 or 6 years and that would have been quite an upbringing to spend my first 6 years there. I remember her saying she wanted a life that wouldn't be like hers, and that took a lot of courage.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Deborah Jankstein was well into her 30s by the time she learned all about being born in prison. I asked her if she ever talked at any length with her adoptive mother about this.
We talked about not those particular things. I did let her know that I knew I had been born in that prison. shortly before she died, and she said, well, that's why we were worried about you when you were wild.
In fact, though, Deborah's adoptive mother had shared items from Deborah's past with her, things that had come from that first year in prison. These were gestures that Deborah knows now were probably very hard for her mother.
She showed me this little toy yarn dog. She took it out of her cedar chest where she kept the linens, and these teeny little knitted sweaters. And I remember her saying, these came with you from your foster care. And I wanted to keep them, and I remember her putting them back in the trunk. And she was uncomfortable, and I wanted them.
This was a couple of sweaters and a little yarn dog, right?
And a little yarn dog. It is, because I have it now. It's beige and pink, and it's wrapped around wire. She made it in prison craft class. But the way I know that is from those prison documents, because in there's a request form where she says, I've made some knitted sweaters and a little toy yarn dog, and I'd like to send it to Madeline in foster care. But my mother had showed me those things when I was growing up, but then she put them back in the cedar chest. She didn't want me to have them. And I got them either when she died or shortly before.
Can you remember putting your hands on those sweaters or that little yarn dog after you discovered that they'd actually been made by your birth mother?
I didn't get to hold them long enough when I was a child. But when I got them, finally, I smelled the yarn, I touched them, and they're treasures. It's funny because I have so many belongings, unfortunately, like, you know, a million people. I've acquired a lot of stuff, and I moved into a house a few years ago, and there's 7 levels to the house. It's a large house. I realized that later, as I sat there and it was empty and the movers were coming, and one of the thoughts I had was, wow, I came from that 6 by 6 foot room to this. And the one item out of those hundreds of boxes that I was frantic to find was that yarn dog. It's become like a character to me almost. You know how some events in your life can be like almost like an object, you know, like bookends that hold you up, mm-hmm. something you look at and hold? That event became really like a character that walked with me, a thing.
Did you ever give that little yarn dog a name?
No, I never did.
Yeah.
I just see it. It's there with the fountain pen that my mother used, the mother I grew up with. She is my mother to me. So that fountain pen and that yarn dog.
It's like one special thing from each mother, right?
Right.
How do you make sense of your place now? If you grew up with this piece of the puzzle missing and you were fortunate enough, and I think it's kind of an amazing set of circumstances that allowed you to fill all that back in. But, you know, it's clear talking to you that you have this real fascination with your birth mother and this real love for the mother who raised you. And so does it leave you feeling in any way conflicted, or does it leave you feeling whole now?
It leaves me feeling whole, and if I have any conflict, it's that I still feel like my story is unlike anybody that I've ever met. But then I also know, you know, there are survivors of war that have stories unlike others. Mm-hmm. So I've accepted it in that way. I don't feel so terminally unique.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Once Deborah Jankstein had put the pieces of her own life together, she started traveling and talking with other women in prison.
I'm aware now of how many, you know, women are in prison. And I remember doing some research about 5 years ago, and there were something like 60,000 kids under 18 with a parent in prison. Now there's over 2 million. And I started feeling like a pioneer and sort of this sense of responsibility, because I have met some kids that have been born in prison, and I meet them inside prison is where I meet them. I should do something with what I've been given. And so for a while I did. I would speak to women, and most of them have kids.
And what is it that you tell them, Deborah? Why do you go to see them?
Well, I started out by telling my story, but not dwelling on that. I went to a lot of prisons around the country, and I had immediate access because I'd mention that story, but then I'd say, and here I am now wanting to speak and inspire and use my story. But I always left out that wild side. I would connect the dots. I was born in prison, and now I have a good life.
The lesson of the story is that you can have a good life even if you're born in prison, right? You were trying to
right.
be that kind of a moral.
Right. And I realized one of the things that makes a difference for me is that I was exposed to a lot and had an education. So my dream would be, I'd love to, out of those 2 million kids, if I could even touches half of 1% or something, and set up a fund to send those girls, the daughters of women in prisons, to college. That would make a big difference.
You said that you have two young kids of your own. How young are they?
7, about to be 8, and I have a 12-year-old. Pre-adolescence, isn't that fun?
Well, how much of your story do they know? How much will you tell them?
I started writing my memoir. I thought, well, if I'm going to tell the world about this, I should talk to my kids. So piece by piece, I started sharing, not everything. They know I'm doing this interview, and my oldest daughter, I think she'll want to listen to it with me. I told them eventually that I was born in a prison and that my mother loved me. And I'd say that one day, and then I'd wait 6 months. And I was very careful about it. Then I told them, well, you know, my mother is kind of wild, my first mother, and that's why she was in prison. You know, I'd eke out little bits of information.
Have you told your kids about the way that the little yarn dog and the fountain pen live together?
They see it. Well, they've grown up with it, which is really interesting. They don't know anything different. Mm-hmm. I've said that my birth mother made that, and then they later knew that, you know, that was sent to me out of prison. And I said it's one of the few things I have. I also have a picture of her up along with the rest of my family. So they see that as well.
And the door on her life, your birth mother's life, is that closed, or is there family there that you've spoken to?
Oh, we talk all the time. I've actually become quite close to them. I took my oldest daughter out for a wedding, and recently there was a death. You know, in a way, they acted like I went away to camp. They knew about me. They had a photo album with a lock of my hair in it that my mother had in prison.
Why did they wind up with that? They got it after your mother died?
Right. It was really so touching to see that photo album. So I am close to that family. I look like her. I love it. You know, the puzzle keeps being put together.
Well, Deborah, I find your story just amazing, and I think you do too.
Well, yeah, it's curious. I feel like it's happened to me.
Yeah, that you can still sort of take it out of its little box and turn it around and look at it with a sense of wonder.
Right. I'm lucky to be here, to be alive.
Thanks for being with me on the program.
Thank you so much.
Deborah Jangstein wrote to me with her story, and then she joined me from a studio at Minnesota Public Radio. You can see a photo of her on our website. That's at thestory.org. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Last week, I talked with Colleen Barbas, who was also mulling over her past. She had a favorite grandfather who passed away while she was traveling in Chile. And immediately after getting the news of her grandfather's death, her group had this series of misadventures, which in the end seemed to all add up to a moment when they avoided confronting a group of knife-wielding bandits. Colleen has assumed, ever since then, that it was the spirit of her grandfather intervening to keep them safe.
It seemed like a really major coincidence that the day I found out that my grandfather had passed was the same day that all of these things happened to basically keep us from walking in on two robbers.
Felipe Bulat lives in Durham, North Carolina. He was listening to Colleen tell her story, and he thought it was very strange because he'd had a very similar experience. Felipe had also been traveling in Chile when a companion's grandparent passed away. This ancestor appeared in a dream, asking the group to speed up its travels. But as it turned out, their car began to behave badly. So they pulled into a police station, and they were told that they had just missed this opportunity to have their sick car placed on the back of a truck and taken out of the mountains free of charge. So Felipe and his friends hopped back into their ailing vehicle, and they were soon rattled by what they saw just down the road.
We saw a truck that had flipped over, and when we were getting closer and closer, we recognized the truck from the description that the police had given us. And it was indeed the truck that we would have been on had we arrived 15 minutes earlier to the police station.
And you would have, your car would have been on the back of the truck, you would have been inside this truck?
Yeah, exactly. We would have been on our car on top of the truck's bed. So, I mean, we would have been definitely injured.
Does anybody remember the dream of the grandmother?
Yeah, exactly. At that point, we were remembering about the dream, and it was weird. It was weird because it wasn't really the only spooky thing that had happened to us during that trip. So we were definitely commenting on the dream at that point. And I think that probably the weirdest thing is that after seeing the truck flip over on the side of the road, the car didn't have any travel for the next 200 miles.
You didn't have any more difficulty with the car?
Any more difficulty with the car. I mean, when we got to the other town, we, of course, took the car to the shop, and they did something to it because it had some problem, but it wasn't anything major. And it was really hard to explain how is it that we have had so much trouble getting to the police station, but after the police station, the car didn't have any travel at all.
How long ago was this, Felipe?
It was probably 6 or 7 years ago.
And in the years since then, do you now take dreams more seriously?
No, not really. I guess had it been my grandmother, I probably would.
It sounds like it still has you wondering, though.
Yeah, it definitely has. It definitely has.
That's Felipe Bulat. If you have a story or a reaction to a story that you hear on the program, let me know. You can go and to our website and leave me a note there. The website is thestory.org. Or you can call and leave me a short message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. Some stories can get pretty frightening. In just a moment, the story of an axe and a brick wall and a mother who comes to the rescue. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. As often as I can, I try to hand the storytelling duties over to you. I'm always interested in the stories of yours that you bring to the story, so much so that we call these your story. Heather Haskins wrote in with one of those stories of childhood drama, trauma, in fact, that lives in her mind more like a collection of images rather than a running video. It happened when Heather was 7. She was living in an apartment in Boston with her mother and her 4-year-old brother. Her dad had just come by to take them out to dinner. Everything seemed normal.
We were just going out of the house, and there were 2 doors, so it was a sort of a narrow passage that you had to go through between the 2 doors, a vestibule. And my dad kind of opened the door with his hand and stood to the side for us to scoot into the vestibule. And from there, he reached above our heads and opened it so that we could walk out ahead of him into the parking lot. And I remember that when he opened that second door, there was a man standing there with a pole with a cement block over his head, raised above his head.
Wait a second, a pole with a cement block attached to it?
Yeah.
Do you mean like a street sign that's been buried
yes.
in cement and has this big chunk of cement at one end?
That's what it was, uh-huh. And it was a big chunk. It was like, it was squared, so it wasn't like somebody had taken a little post hole digger and there was a little splotch of cement. It was like a big block.
So this is a heavy thing this man is holding
up. It's a heavy thing. This guy was huge.
And are you standing right there looking up at him?
I was in front. My dad opened the door and he was kind of above me with the cement pole raised. And my impression is that he was about to smash the door down with it. But when my father opened the door and I was standing there, he was thrown off. He took a couple of steps backwards. This thing is heavy. You know, you lift it up, you expect you're going to swing it back down. You don't expect to be holding it above your head. So he took a couple of steps backward.
Or you don't expect to be confronted by a 6-year-old girl.
Something like that. But I wasn't frightened at all because it was one of those weird moments where you kind of don't know what's going on yet, even though it's weird and nobody's indicating that it's weird. So I just sort of ran out the door.
You didn't scream or run back?
No. In fact, I remember that I thought of myself as a future tap dancing star or something like that. I was always doing what in my mind was a tap dance routine, even though I didn't know what a tap dance routine would consist of, but I was always tapping around, spazzy little 6-year-old, and I think I just tap-tappity-tapped right out the door and then just kept right on tapping.
Now, if I had been that really big guy about to smash the door in with the pole and the cement, I would have been very confused.
That's what it was. It was confusing because it wasn't like, ah, oh my God, Daddy, save me. It wasn't like that at all. It was like, da-da-da, da-da-da. It's just surreal.
What was the moment when you realized that this, in fact, was not something normal at the back of the house?
Well, my father put us in the car. That was the first thing that he did. He opened up the car. He must have picked us up and tossed us in the back seat because we were kind of scooched back from where my father was. And as he was, I think, fumbling with my brother or trying to fumble with the car door or something, this man actually came into the car. And he kind of came hand over hand like he was crawling toward us, like something out of a movie. He had a deranged look on his face, like he was like panting, crazy eyes, very weird, not normal at all. And I heard my father say, "Oh, no, you don't." My father grabbed him from the scruff of the neck or from the shoulders or something and pulled him out of the car. And after that, the next thing that happened was that this man was, he was fighting my mom, but it wasn't really much of a contest because he was really big. He picked her up like she was nothing. He picked her up like she was a piece of paper, and he slammed her against a brick wall that was dividing our parking lot from the next parking lot over.
Did he throw her against the wall or just sort of hold her up against the wall?
He held her. The image that I have is of him with my mom by the shoulders up off the ground, and her, she had long hair and she had a long skirt on, and he hit her, he slammed her against that wall so hard that her skirt and her hair flew out in front of her. And that's the image that I have of her sort of frozen in time against the wall up in the air as if the wind was blowing behind her, but she's of course against a brick wall.
And where's your father at this point?
My father could only have been getting the axe out of the trunk. We didn't have an ice scraper. We had an axe. And when the car windows would ice over, which it happens often in Boston that they do, my father would chisel it off with an axe, just a wood handled axe.
This story's getting creepy now. There's an axe.
Yeah. It's really creepy. It's really freaky because, well, there's two weapons now. There's that cement block thing, which if he had really been in his right mind and wanted to finish us off quickly, he could have made quick work of it by bludgeoning everybody with that thing. But he didn't look normal. He didn't look like he was in his right mind. He looked deranged. He looked confused.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. So there's 7-year-old Heather Haskins. She's in the car with her baby brother, and a total stranger who's attacking the family has just slammed her mother against a brick wall. Her father has an axe.
My father was on top of the car, I think. We could hear stomping on the car. It was really loud, and the car is shaking. So the two of them must have been fighting up there on top of the car. But while the scuffle ensued, this man took the axe away from my father. And the next image that I have in my mind is both of them on the ground in front of the car. And he had my father down. And as I remember it, he had the axe above him, just as he had had the pole above him earlier. He had the axe above his head, and he was going to kill my father with it. He was going to kill my father. He was going to bring it down on him. And at that moment, my mother ran up behind him, took it away from him, took the axe away from him, and she did a sort of a roundhouse swing, took it from him, and in one motion swung it around behind her back and clocked the guy in the side of the head with the blunt end of it.
This woman has just been thrown into a brick wall, and now she's taken an axe away from some attacker and whacked him on the head with it. She sounds like a kind of a strong person.
She was. You wouldn't have seen her and said, "Wow, big strong woman." She was average in size, but she was tough. She kind of still is. She has a tough streak, and I think any mother, when you're in a situation like that, is if you have if you have a shred of tough streak in you, it's absolutely going to come to the surface. And my mom had more than a shred.
Did this guy go down after your mother hit him?
Yeah, he did. He went down. He went down. She hit him. She hit him a couple of times. She hit him three times.
With the axe?
And, yeah, with a blunt end.
And what's going on inside the car at this point, you and your little brother? I mean, you're watching this thing. You're screaming. You're bug-eyed. What's going on?
My brother was screaming and crying, and I think I was too. I remember that's the soundtrack that's going on as all of this is playing out. Is I can just hear him crying, and I think me crying too. I think that was what, more than anything else, signaled to me that this isn't just a bad scene. This is a really, really, really bad scene. My brother knows it's bad. My brother is sobbing and crying.
I'm assuming that the man, the attacker, after getting whacked three times with the blunt end of the axe, is not getting up.
He did not get up. I don't remember him getting up again.
And how was your father? How was your mother?
Well, the tenants of the apartment, who had a front row seat to all of this out of their back kitchen windows, all came running out, and we became aware of them at that point. I'm not sure how long they'd been standing there, but they were holding things like frying pans and rolling pins and brooms, ridiculous household implements of battle, I suppose, that they were gonna use to protect themselves or jump into the fray. But once they got down there, they were all just standing against the building. Nobody really wanted to get involved. I guess they didn't realize that there was an axe switching hands. And then police cars, and I remember the lights, and I think that took a while, but I don't remember anything else from that night. I remember afterwards my mom kept assuring us that he wasn't going to come back for us or anybody else ever again. It was all over. He's been hurt badly, and he won't ever be able to hurt anybody else ever again.
You have since spoken to your mother. I mean, do you know what happened to the man, or?
Yeah, well, I always knew that she'd cracked his skull, and she had, I think, led me to believe that he was done for good, maybe because she didn't want us to be scared or have nightmares about it or something like that.
Yeah.
So I imagined, I thought that he had been disabled, put in a wheelchair or something, but I asked her about it recently, and she said no, he was in the hospital for 3 months, and after 3 months he recovered.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Heather Haskins says the story of the man with the axe is kind of a strange one, because wild as it sounds, it really didn't change things in her family.
I did ask my mom how she felt about it, and she was focusing on how annoyed she was at my father for not being the man and taking care of the situation. And I said, but didn't you feel vindicated? If it was me and I just saved my children's lives, I would feel really vindicated. And she was like, well, yeah, of course, I suppose. But that didn't seem to change the way we related to each other. Nothing about this incident changed our relationships. My parents didn't really speak about it with us. I'm sure they didn't want to scare us. I'm sure they were worried that we were going to be fearful and terrified for our safety. But actually, it was the opposite. For me, I felt that anything that happened, it was going to be handled. You know, crazed, deranged psychopaths wielding weapons, no big deal. My mom will get them. My mom will take care of them. And my brother, who was a little bit younger and deeply involved in fantasy play, deeply involved in invisible imaginary sword fights and all of this stuff, became very, very into, I'll say he got really into this particular fantasy of aliens and monsters and just whatever you can imagine, whatever you see on TV attacking. And he would be running. We would always walk in Boston, because Boston, you really don't need a car there. And my mom didn't have one, so we'd walk everywhere, and he'd be running up ahead with his imaginary sword play, and he'd the monsters would be coming and the aliens would be coming and they'd be winning the battle. And then all of a sudden, the mommy would swoop in and the mommy would save the day. And this went on for a while. It really stuck with him. Mommy was, there was no hero.
She was the superhero.
Oh, there's no hero more powerful or more amazing than a mommy.
Tell me something, Heather. You were 6 years old when this mm-hmm. happened, and you saw, you know, your parents mm-hmm. battling off this bad guy.
Yeah.
In a way, it's one of those events that could have changed your life, your brother's life, your mother's, your
Absolutely.
Father's life.
Absolutely. And that's why this story sticks with me, because it is the freakiest thing that's probably ever happened. And at the same time, it's the most normal thing. And that's what's so weird about it. It was just all so normal.
Yeah, in what way is it normal, though? I mean, there's nothing normal in the story that you've just told. It's like a scene out of a horror movie.
It is, but for me, it was as if our lives were saved and everything returned to normal so quickly in that moment that you could never go back and undo it. It sort of cemented the normalcy of being safe from that kind of a scary, unspecified, mysterious danger coming out of the dark night.
You mean because it ended the way it did, in a strange sort of way, it ended up being a happy story?
It was a very happy story, actually, because my brother was completely buoyed by it. He got a really important impression of the power of women, I think, at a very important age. I needed to see it too, because as a woman myself, I like to imagine that if anything happened to my kids, come hell or high water, I would rise to the occasion. And I could rise to the occasion. I am my mother's daughter. And if she can pull that out, then it's got to be in me too. And that, I have a 5-year-old son, and if my 5-year-old son, oh, just thinking about it, if my 5-year-old son was running around absorbed in fantasy play about me as a hero, that would mean so much to me. I can't imagine how wonderful I would feel.
Good guys can win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And good girls can win.
Heather Haskins wrote in with her story. You can do exactly the same thing. You can go to our website at thestory.org. There's lots of buttons there where you can leave me a short note with a story that you think is worthy of merit for our segment called Your Story. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. You can also write to me if you have something you'd like to contribute. Our mailing address is The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. That's 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. Or you can call and leave a message on our The Story telephone line. It's 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. That's exactly what Becky New did. She's a recent fan of The Story, and she's been listening, and she knew that she had a story to contribute, or a family story that was worth listening to. She finally picked up the phone and got in touch with us. She told me the story about her father. His name is John Staples, and tomorrow John celebrates his 86th birthday. Tomorrow is also the anniversary of the U.S. Marine Corps attack on the Japanese island of Iwo Jima. Now, we've all been reminded of the historical importance of that event this past year with films like Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. So the point is this. On the day when John Staples was celebrating his 23rd birthday, he was also a second lieutenant with the Marines and part of the first wave of Marines who clambered ashore the island of Iwo Jima, February 19th, 1945. That was 63 years ago tomorrow. Now, I'll talk with John Staples about that experience and his memories of that day and his sense of the historic importance of Iwo Jima. And it all started with a phone call from his daughter, Becky. 1-888-966-9862. John Staples will be here on the program tomorrow. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.